a deliberate plan by Donald Trump to just get rid of NATO. And it started 2 weeks ago when he turned over, or directed Hegseth to turn over to the Brits responsibilities for this Ukrainian support group. This group is supposedly comprised of 50 nations, and the U.S. used to chair it and bring people together to shake them down, to give, you know, give us this, give us that, give us money, give us tank. Well, Trump said, no, we're not doing that anymore. The Brits could be in charge. Well, putting the Brits in charge of that actually puts the onus up on them. It takes the United States out of the picture.
Larry Johnson, good morning to you. How are you, my friend?
I am well, fortunately. Staying away from the flu.
Well, welcome back, and I hope you're feeling you're trending up here. A lot of stuff going on internationally, and that's, you're one of my gutsy people that I just love and respect and want to get your opinion on. J.D. Vance was in Europe here over the last week.
I don't think they're inviting him back.
In a firestorm. Yeah.
If he goes back, he needs to take a food taster.
Yeah, right. But it's all that even started before that. What is going on really with NATO? And let's start with that and really the Trump administration's position on that as you see it.
Well, the NATO speech was Hegseth, not Vance. Yeah. Vance was the Munich Security Conference.
That's right.
Which is related, but what Vance said also is relevant to NATO. I think we saw the beginning of the end of NATO with the combination, the 1-2 punch of Hegseth and Vance. The Hegseth's signal was basically, we're not going to fight anymore in Ukraine. We're out. Yeah. If you guys want to continue it, that's fine, but you're not going to do it as part of NATO. You can do it as part of the European Union. You guys can get together, you know, raise the money. And we're not giving any more weapons to Ukraine. But if you want to buy them from us and give them to Ukraine, that's fine. Going forward, Ukraine's going to have to pay. And all of a sudden, the Freddy the Freeloader Europeans have suddenly said, oh, my God, we've got to take responsibility. I think this is a deliberate plan by Donald Trump to just get rid of NATO. And it started 2 weeks ago when he turned over, or directed Hegseth to turn over, to the Brits responsibilities for this Ukrainian support group. This group is supposedly comprised of 50 nations. And the U.S. used to chair it and bring people together to shake them down, to give, you know, give us this, give us that, give us money, give us tank. Well, Trump said, no, we're not doing that anymore. The Brits could be in charge. Well, putting the Brits in charge of that actually puts the onus up on them. It takes the United States out of the picture. So this, you know, we heard for, you know, 4 years of Joe Biden about how united NATO was. NATO's, oh man, they're really... couldn't be stronger. Now we've proved this not the case. In the immediate aftermath of that Munich Security Conference, where Vance correctly called out the Europeans for their hypocrisy. And, you know, that, I mean, just a simple illustration. I could take you to Moscow today, have you go to the Red Square, and have you bow your head, have you get down on your knees and be visibly praying. And you know what would happen to you? Nothing.
Right.
You would be allowed to pray.
Right.
I can take you to London and to go outside the parliament. Have you do the same thing. You would be arrested and put in jail. So who's the authoritarian? Who's the totalitarian dictator? It ain't Putin. It's the Brits. It's the Germans. I mean, you know, the Germans are, as we saw the other night on the 60 Minutes piece, they're arresting people for what they post on social media. That if you voice an opinion or express support, you know, it's one thing if you go on social media and say, I'm going to kill, you know, I'm going to kill the president. He ought to be dead. Okay. That is, in any legal jurisdiction, at least in the United States, that's called assault. That is a criminal act. You are assaulting somebody. You're making a threat to inflict violence. So, you know, that's one thing to police that. But to, you know, to endorse, say, somebody who's making fun of transgender claims that men can have babies, and then to, you know, prosecute them, wrong. So, what, you know, Vance, to his credit, called the Germans and the French and the Brits out for that. They were stunned, absolutely stunned. They didn't know what to do. And so immediately, Macron assembled a meeting with a select group on Monday in Paris, France, the Brits, the Germans, the Ruta, von der Leyen, you know, Ursula von der Leyen, but I call her Fond of Lying. And, you know, the people that they thought they could count on, and they failed to come to a consensus. They were actually fighting with each other. We're going to send troops. No, we're not going to send troops. Well, we're going to send, you know, they couldn't decide whether to send troops or not. They couldn't decide how much money. And they could make any agreement they want about, oh, yeah, let's give them $700 billion. You know, they couldn't scrape up, you know, 70 cents between them, probably. So this was a pretty remarkable event, historic.
Yeah, it's interesting because they said, yeah, the whole money aspect, where are they going to get the money? That's what I immediately thought of. But then really what I'm thinking of here is, okay, what's next then? Is it just going to be like, I mean, who's going to pay for NATO? Which, again, this couldn't happen sooner for my mind, and that's just my own opinion. But yeah, what's going to happen? How do you see this playing out? And then after that, talk to me about the relationship between Trump and Putin as you see it. I say it's complicated, or it's a complicated thing, but I don't know if it is or not. Tell me about that.
Well, as far as funding NATO, I think it's going to wither away. It's not going to fall apart overnight, but it is going to wither away. The United States is not going to be stepping up an increasing budget for it. You know, that falls under the Pentagon anyway. You know, and there's going to be an increased, you know, I think Trump's vision is, you know, pretty good. You know, we've been in Europe now for 80 years. World War II ended 80 years ago, May. What are we still doing there? I mean, when do you come home? When do you say, our work is finished here? Because, what, do you stay another 80 years or 400 years? I mean, you know, what, you got to come to recognize that you step back and say, okay, are these countries, number one, capable of defending themselves if they make it a priority? Well, the answer to that is yes. But most are not capable of defending themselves because they haven't made it a priority. You know, if you had a friend that every time you guys went out to bars or to restaurants, and your friend always paid the bill, he's a great friend to have. You don't have to pay a cent, man. I'll go with you, sure. The time that he comes out and says, hey, man, I forgot my wallet, you got to pay. You go, oh, well, wait a second, man. I'm not ready for that. So, the other thing is, what's the threat? You know, Russia's not going to invade them. And it has been Europe that has consistently, over the last 20 years, along with the United States, carried out military exercises to threaten Russia. So I think you're going to see a gradual withering away of NATO. It's become irrelevant. As to the relationship between Putin and Trump, it's not a warm personal relationship at all. You know, from Putin's standpoint, he's not sure he can trust Trump. Donald Trump, when in his first term, sent weapons to Ukraine that were used to attack and kill Russians. Donald Trump walked away, abrogated the Intermediate Nuclear Forces agreement to control intermediate range ballistic missiles. And then Donald Trump continued to enforce and allow sanctions against Russia to continue, didn't lift them. So in terms of this relationship, the onus is on Trump. I mean, it's really like, if you have an estranged couple and one partner is the one who, you know, cheated on the other and, you know, is guilty of physical abuse and wants to come back and get into the relationship. You know, the one who was victimized is going to say, we'll take this slow. We'll wait and see. You're going to have to see some, you know, visible proof that there's a change. So in this, while Trump in his public pronouncements with respect to Putin and Russia suggests that, you know, United States is sort of compelling Putin, forcing Putin into some of these positions, the opposite is the truth. Putin said, okay, well, yeah, we'll sit and talk. Yeah, let's talk. You want to meet? Okay, let's meet. You want us to stop fighting? No. And hell no. We're not going to stop fighting until you guys cut off all your aid to Ukraine, until you guys stop supplying mercenaries to Ukraine, until you stop supplying intelligence to Ukraine. You know, you stop first. Then we'll talk. But beyond that, we can talk about, you know, having relations where we can have our diplomats or ambassadors in place, and we can expand, you know, the consulates can be allowed to reopen. Yeah, we can do all of that. But Ukraine it's not going to end on your terms, Donald. It's going to end on mine. That's where Putin is.
Got it. So about that, and Trump and really Elon Musk, and it's been fantastic, just the auditing that they're doing, going through all the federal government, all the different departments.
Right.
Are they going to get, and my question is are they going to get to Ukraine? Because that's going to be, I'm making an assumption here, but I believe this to be true. That's going to be wrought with a lot of fraud.
Well, they're, yes, eventually, I think, but I know that there is another investigation underway already because of some whistleblowers that has identified $49 billion. That's B, not M, that have been stolen and are in banks in the Caribbean. So that money is actually right now being traced to see if the United States can recover it, recoup it. It raises some really interesting points of leverage for Donald Trump going forward.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
You know, if Zelensky's position gets untenable, then he decides, oh my God, I got to get out. I'm going to go to the United States. Trump could say, no, you're not. Or, yeah, okay, you've got how many properties here in the United States? Good. We're going to confiscate. We'll leave you with one. We're going to take all the others and return that money to the U.S. Treasury because you stole it. You didn't earn that off your presidential salary. Mm-hmm. You stole it. So I could, you know, and I'm shocked. Zelensky really is a dummy. He doesn't value his survival highly, because he's spending like almost every day now insulting Trump. And if I was in Zelensky's position, the last person I want to be insulting and get crossways with is Donald Trump, because without Donald Trump, you know, Zelensky's going to have to rely on the Brits to save his ass. Good luck with that. Right.
Or a NATO that's not going to be anymore. Unlikely. Yeah, it's going to be interesting how this plays out. Yeah, and really reworking the global map here over the next, really over the next 3 or 4 years. I'm optimistic though, how, that this war in Ukraine and really NATO, and Russia will be coming to a quick end here. So we shall see.
Well, yeah, the Russians are, you know, making advances. Today it was announced, Putin announced that from the Kursk region, the Russian troops had now entered into Ukrainian territory from Kursk. They're taking a position that will be, that's important in terms of cutting off the flow of logistics that have gone up into that salient in Kursk that has been used, exploited by the Ukrainian soldiers for, you know, 5 months now. So this, by doing this, they're positioning themselves basically to cut off and surround those Ukrainians. They're dead. They're going to be dead. So I think what you're going to see in the next, really in the next month or two, is a dramatic acceleration of the Russian offensive across the entire front.
Really?
Yeah. And Ukraine's military situation is going to get more desperate by the day, not less.
And then will Zelensky come to the table and negotiate? And if he does, Putin really doesn't have to do anything with him.
What's he going to negotiate?
Right, that's what I mean.
Zelensky is faced with, he's going to negotiate terms of surrender.
Yeah.
And again, the Russians have stipulated some things that Zelensky must do before they'll even sit down and talk to Ukraine. They will not talk to Zelensky. Zelensky is not he is, in the Russian view, an illegitimate president now. He, mm-hmm. he violated the Constitution. He's not following the law of Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are really, particularly Putin, who's a lawyer, they are sticklers about adhering to the law. You know, you have the law for one reason, so that it doesn't have to, it doesn't boil down to just the arbitrary whim of one person.
Yeah. Imagine that. Let's pivot a little bit to Israel, not a little lot to Israel. That happened so fast, I guess, with Netanyahu coming on stage with Trump. My first thought was, Netanyahu must have some tremendous pressure on him to come to do that, number one. And then number two is to book a call with you to see what's going on. So give me your thoughts on what happened there and how is that playing out. And let me know.
Which incident are you referring to?
Well, this was, 2 weeks ago, Netanyahu.
When he came to see Trump?
Yeah.
And Trump made his announcement about, we're going to create Gaza on the Riviera, or the Riviera on Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to think about that. I'm assuming that's just Trump being Trump. But for Netanyahu to come to wanting to stop killing people and to stop, you know, bring some peace here, or I don't know, bring some peace. It just seems like this is all U.S. led and Trump led here to bring an end to this.
Well, I've seen some documents, reportedly from the IDF. So they've been lying about their casualties. They have been grossly understating the number of dead and wounded Israeli soldiers. It is, in terms of, you know, if you put it in terms of per capita, losses per capita, you know, because there are 8 million people, what they've lost just in this last 15 months of warfare against Hamas and Hezbollah would be twice the casualties that the United States suffered in Vietnam.
Wow. Okay.
It's that severe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has a political consequence. The Israel is, you've got to separate Israel's rhetoric, what they're saying in public, from what they're actually capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they insist they're going to defeat and wipe out Hamas. Really? Didn't do it in 15 months. And, you know, let's sit down and honestly and objectively look at this. Hamas is not an army. Hamas is, best, let's call it a militia force, a guerrilla force. They've got small arms. They don't have artillery. They don't have tanks. They don't have armored personnel carriers. They don't have any kind of air power, air force at all, helicopters or fixed wing. Israel, by contrast, has all of that. So, and Israel had the enemy surrounded, defining Hamas as their enemy. Their backs were up against the Mediterranean. So you had them in a confined area for 15 months. Israel couldn't defeat them. Okay? And well, Israel talked a tough game. Yeah, we're going to go back in. We're going to destroy Hamas. No, I doubt it. All you can do is go back in and get more of your guys killed. But yeah, they're going to kill a lot of Palestinians, no doubt about that. And they may kill a number of Hamas fighters. But Israel's not going to fight its way out of it. Israel does not have a strong enough military to defeat Hamas and Hezbollah. Does not.
No.
They're confronted with that. I'm hoping. I don't know if Trump was serious or not about displacing the Palestinians. I want to believe that Trump was putting out this outrageous idea in order to provoke the Arab nations to step in and say, whoa, wait a second. No, you're not going to do that. Keep them there. We'll rebuild it. We'll take responsibility.
Okay.
So if was that a negotiating ploy by Trump to get the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Saudis, and others to come together and say, okay, we'll keep the Palestinians there in place and rebuild Gaza. I said, I want to believe that. I don't know if that's true. Time will only tell. What we do know is that Trump's, when he announced that plan, it wasn't really a plan. Because he made clear, well, we're not going to put U.S. boots on the ground, and we're not going to pay for it. Okay, so explain to me again how you can get the Palestinians out of Gaza and into these fabulous new homes that are located where, and how long did it take to build them? So, it's just, he's talking conceptually, not practically in terms of an actual plan. Netanyahu played along, but I think deep down he was troubled with, wait a second, we own Gaza, not you, United, not Donald Trump. Donald Trump says he's going to take it. That's not in the Old Testament. It says this land is our land, not theirs. So it was embraced by some of the religious extremists, the Zionists, the Smotriches, the Ben-Gavirs. But you see, it hadn't really gone anywhere.
Yeah.
And also remember, Trump said, though if all the hostages aren't released by Saturday noon, there'll be hell to pay. Well, Saturday noon came and went. The ceasefire remains intact. Hamas continues to release slowly the hostages it took in order to secure the release of the hostages that Israel has taken. So the hopes are that this peace process remains intact for now. At least the people in Gaza are relatively safe. They're not getting bombed and strafed every day like they were. Same can't be said for the Palestinians in the West Bank. And it's still a volatile, dangerous situation. But because of the ceasefire, Hamas, Hezbollah and the Houthis have put their guns away for now.
Right. So two questions about all that then. What exactly is going to happen to Israel now? And I think you make a great point. It is what they project and say is different than the reality. If you will. but how does game that out for me? And then where does Iran fit into all of this? I know they're not they view Trump as somebody to be reckoned with, but what is that relationship going to be now? Is that more threatening? But they were always threatening also under Biden, if you would.
Well, Iran remains the big boogeyman for the United States. You know, and this is what's so ironic. We keep talking about, they're the biggest sponsor of terrorism. And we launched a terrorist strike this way with the United States this week. And we took out this top terrorist leader who is part of ISIS. Oh, wait a second. Iran's been fighting ISIS for the last, 12 years. That's a Sunni group. That's not a Shia group. So, I mean, the reality is the terrorist groups, the groups that we identify as terrorists that carry out attacks against civilians, and as well as they call it terrorism when they carry out attacks on U.S. military bases. That's not terrorism. That's war. That's why you guys get to wear uniforms, carry guns. Okay? Different category. Nonetheless, those groups are not controlled by Iran at all. They are opposed to Iran. They view Iran in as bad terms as the United States does. They're a bunch of apostate Muslims. So, the United States nonetheless wants to continue to provoke a confrontation with Iran. And we've got now what I call the red herring, the Iran's nuclear bomb, working on a nuclear bomb. No, they're not. I'm convinced of that beyond any doubt for two reasons. First and foremost, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has still said, no, we're not building a bomb. It's against Islam. He thinks the bomb's evil and thinks it violates the what it means to be a good Muslim. But secondly, the Iranians signed a strategic security agreement with Russia on January 17th, 3 days before Trump was inaugurated. And part of that deal stipulates how Russia is going to help Iran with its nuclear program for energy production, nothing else. And the Russians have been particularly careful over the years not to proliferate nuclear weapons, nuclear technology. So they're really in a position to verify and certify that, hey, no, Iran's not getting a bomb. And that's one of the issues that, ironically, that the Washington delegation discussed in Riyadh with Sergei Lavrov and Usarov. So what you're looking at here is prior to that January 17th agreement, there was not a clear relationship, legal relationship, treaty relationship between Russia and Iran. There is now. Israel is pressing the United States for permission to launch military strikes against Iran to, quote, take out their nuclear capability. But Israel cannot do this without U.S. direct military support. Now that Iran and Russia have this relationship, and the United States is talking to Russia, it's going to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the United States to countenance any kind of military attack on Iran. If such an attack takes place, if Israel, for whatever reason, decides, well, hell, we're going to do it on our own. I doubt if they could do it on their own, but let's just assume that they could. Their belief that they've destroyed Iran's air defense system, false. And then Iran has an enormous capability for retaliating against Israel, and the ensuing retaliation, I believe, would be very destructive for Israel. They'll experience a level of destruction that they have not experienced ever in their history, modern history anyway.
You know, thinking about this and working through this, and I'm trying to think of it as, I'm not sure this is the appropriate way to look at it, but think of in terms of winners and losers. It seems to me like the winners on this is actually Iran, because of the relationships with Israel. I'm not Israel, but with Russia. And I don't see I see a lot of rhetoric coming out, perhaps, but I don't see any action coming, which was good. And also, ironically, I think it's also Israel, because now they have an out, and now it seems like Netanyahu is put in check, if you would. So perhaps they get to go along or go back to what they were doing. And also perhaps Saudi Arabia to exercise influence, if you would. And the clear loser in all this is Netanyahu, I think, and the aggression of Israel, if that makes sense. What are your thoughts?
Well, no, I would disagree that, you know, take Netanyahu's not the, he's part of the problem, but he's not the problem.
He's not the problem. Okay.
If you get rid of Netanyahu, Israel's not going to suddenly go, oh, hey, man, we're all in favor of a two-state solution. Let's sit down and negotiate with the Palestinians. No. The majority of the Israeli population are Zionists, committed Zionists, and they want to see the extermination of the Palestinians. They want them out. They don't want them in the land anymore. They want them gone. So that, you know, the problem's the Zionists. It goes beyond Netanyahu. Yeah, right. Netanyahu's, he certainly got some significant political problems, as well as he's suffering some health issues.
Yeah.
There's not a clear path forward for a peaceful resolution of this, and the odds are high that they'll start killing each other again. But it's important to recognize and acknowledge that despite all the cheerleading and rah, rah, rah nonsense about Israel's mighty military power that goes on here in the States, you know, they've got to recognize that Israel's, they've got limited capabilities, namely because they're a reserve force and they're a very small country.
Yeah.
And
by a bunch of Muslim countries.
Well, I put it in perspective this way. Israel's about 8 million people, New York City and the surrounding boroughs, about 9 million. Israel, the public figures for soldiers killed during the last 15 months is almost 800. Now, the real number I'm told is closer to 5,000. But let's just go with the 800 number. What would be the reaction in New York City if 800 cops were killed in 1 year?
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. I mean, they go crazy if one or two are killed.
Mm.
Can you, so that's what I say, put that into that kind of perspective, that sure. A population the size of New York City is what it is Israel as an entire nation. And it can't afford those kinds of losses. There are large relative to the size of the population.
Got it. So let's end on this, and this is really my final question. Are things then both in Ukraine and Russia conflict, as well as in the Middle East, are things going to be more stable then under the new administration and the new people that Trump has in place, or is it still just a tinderbox waiting to explode?
Well, I would hope that there'd be a quick resolution to a lot of these thorny issues, but there won't be. But the good news is Russia and the United States are talking, and they're going to normalize relations. So the first step is to normalize relations. Once that's normalized, then it's to figure out a process of, basically, it's going to be up to the United States to coerce Ukraine into coming to the surrender table. Because Russia is not going to stop fighting. Russia realizes it's been betrayed over and over and over and over and over by the West, that it cannot trust the West. You know, back in 2015, there was this battle of the Baltsava, which is Bakhmut. And the Ukrainian forces out of Donbass, the Donbass militia, those who are aligned with Russia, backed by Russia, with Russian support, defeated the Ukrainian army, forced them out of Bakhmut. And at the time, there were negotiations underway for the signing of Minsk II. So Russia agreed to halt its offensive operations. So they stopped in place, ceasefire, signed on to Minsk II. Well, it turned out Minsk II was a complete fraud. It was a lie. There was no intent to actually bring it into the fighting. It was a complete, it was a total lie. And Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande later admitted to that. It was only to buy time for Ukraine to rearm, re-equip. So Russia's been burned, and that's just one example. I'm going to go to many others. And so because of that, Russia's going to insist upon some very, very concrete steps, things the West and Ukraine are going to have to do before Russia will even sit down and say, okay, yeah, we'll move forward towards a curtailing military operations.
Got it. Okay.
Well, Larry, a big fan of your work. I always enjoy talking with you. If people want to know more about you, follow you, how do they go about to do that? How do they find you?
Follow me at sonar21.com, SONAR21.com.
And that's where I found you. So I'll put all of this in the show notes. I just want to thank you so much for your time. I always enjoy our talks.
Hey, Andy, thank you for having me. Appreciate it. Have a great day, man.
You too. Take care.